place better than any on earth, but a place you are nonetheless lucky to have escaped.
Why?
Because of the Turks.
Oh.
A place where everyone speaks the Piper Girls' private at-home language right out in the open, and everyone looks like their mother.
Tell us about the old country again, Mama.
On the kitchen cot, before Kathleen gets home, they sink into Materia's soft body, which provides a pillow for each head, her plushy smell of fresh wet bread and oil, a pot of bezella and rose with lamb on the stove, the lid buzzing sleepily. Outside, the winter drizzle blurs the window.
Lebanon is the most beautiful place in the world. There are gentle breezes. It's always warm there. The buildings are white. They sparkle in the sun like diamonds, and the sea is crystal blue. Lebanon is the pearl of the Orient. And Beirut, where I was born, is the Paris of the Middle East.
Can we go live there?
No. You were lucky to be born on this damp gray rock in the Atlantic, beautiful in its own mournful way.
Because of the Turks?
Yes.
This island, familiar to famished Irish and gnarly-kneed Scots, who had been replaced by sheep in their old country.
Mama, what's Turkish delight?
It's nasty.
Oh.
Cape Breton Island is not a pearl. Scratch anywhere and you'll find coal. But some day, millions of years from now, it may be a diamond. Cape Breton diamond.
Mama, tell us about Jitti and Sitti again.
Your Jitti was my daddy. He and my mother, your Sitti, came here with nothing, and they worked very hard. They had many children, and they prospered.
Why didn't they stay?
They missed the old country.
Someday we'll go see them, eh?
When you're a grown woman with children of your own, you can go there.
Mama, tell us about the good Muslim lady again.
Muslim.
Muslim.
She was a good woman. Her name was Mahmud. Many years ago, when your Jitti was a baby, the Turks came to his village in the old country. They were looking for Christian babies to kill. The Mahmud woman took your Jitti and put him among her own children. When the Turks came to the door and said, "Are there any Christian babies here?" she said, "No, all these children are my own." And to convince them, she put your Jitti to her own breast and suckled him. The Turks went away. When he grew up, your Jitti took the Muslim lady's name out of gratitude, even though he was really a Christian.
Oh, Mama, can we see the picture?
And Materia gets out the picture of her and James in front of the painted Roman arch from that long-ago day at Wheeler's Photographic. Mercedes and Francis pore over the photo, when Mama and Daddy were young. In Francis's mind, the arch leads sometimes to the old country, sometimes to the war.
When's Daddy coming home?
Soon. We must pray.
Materia has heard from her sister Camille. Camille waited outside the Mahmud kitchen door for the Jewish butcher to finish his weekly cup of tea with her mother. When he came out, Camille handed him a flat square parcel. She asked him to give it to Materia, and without waiting for a reply, hurried away. Benny passed it on to Mrs. Lvovitz, who gave it to Materia. Materia cried when she opened the gift. An Arabic record. Its paper cover bore the watercolor of Beirut by night. She looked inside eagerly for a note, half expecting the childish printing of years ago, smiling at the memory even as it hurt her heart.
My little Camille, you're the prettiest of all of us. Ya helvi.
But there was only a scrap of brown paper and the words, "I'm married now." At least once a week, Materia takes the record from the hope chest, carries Kathleen's gramophone down to the kitchen and winds it up. She aims the brass bloom and places the needle on the spinning wax. First, the antechamber of snowy static, airlock to another world, then open sesame. The dirbeki beats rhythm, ankle bells and finger cymbals prance in. The oud alights and tiptoes, the woodwind uncoils, legless ancestor of the highland bagpipe, rising reedy to undulate over thick strings, strumming now in unison. It all weaves and pulses into a spongy mesh for the female voice to penetrate. No words yet, a moan between joy and lament. The orchestra suspends itself below, trembling up at the voice, licorice, liquid, luring. Dance with me before I make love to you later, later, soon. Materia gets up and dances the dabke. Her mother taught her this dance, and Materia has taught Francis and Mercedes. The dabke is a continuous series of small lilting steps and quarter swirls, which sway your hips, laze your shoulders back and forth, and breeze your arms like treetops over your head. Your hands are supple seaweed, waving on unresisting wrists, encircling, grazing, flirting with each other. This dance works best if you are buxom, but anyone can do it. It's that kind of dance. And although officially a man is supposed to lead a line of pretty girls, the dabke is for everyone. At weddings, at baptisms, with children, grandmothers, anyone. That's why the eyes are so important, because the whole point of the dabke is to get up and do it in the center of the gathering, where you acknowledge everyone until you pick out the person you will invite into the dance. Then you lower your arms toward them, hands still weaving to the music, and you lure that person until they get up and join you because they can't refuse. Then they become the center. The dabke is all about hips and breeze, whereas if you find yourself at a Kaylee, Celtic step dancing is all about feet and knees. Both can be danced in a kitchen by anyone. The dabke is a big favorite with Francis and Mercedes. They'll do it as long as Materia can hold up, which in these early days is a long time. She teaches them a whole bunch of Arabic songs, as well as the way to wail them while dancing. The trick is that the dancing and singing are unrepeatable. Once you know this, you're ready to start learning. When the precious record wears out, Francis innovates with a comb and wax paper to approximate the reeds and strings. Far from thinking it a sacrilege, Materia considers it ingenious. And it is. Put the shell to your ear. You can hear the Mediterranean. Open the hope chest. You can smell the old country. Holy angels. Perhaps her requirements were too great, or her indulgence for human weakness too small, for her attempts to form a friendship had always ended in disappointment. Claudia by A.L.O.E. Sister St. Monica's class is decorated with a map of the world, a chart of a volcano in cross-section, a collection of fossils, and a color print of her namesake. It hangs above the blackboard. In it, St. Monica holds a book open on her lap. But she is not reading. She is gazing off, seemingly unaware of another pair of eyes peering up from the book itself, one on each page. When she is overcome by boredom, Kathleen's eyes often stray to this picture, it being the one focal point for covert daydreaming not disapproved of by Sister St. Monica, who is given to impromptu anecdotes on the lives of the saints in and amongst lessons of the earth's crust and its chief capitals. The girls all know that the prairies are the breadbasket of Canada, and that St. Monica was the mother of the greatest of all church fathers St. Augustine. In his youth, Augustine lived in sin with a heathen African woman. His mother prayed for his redemption, and one day, when Augustine was strolling in a garden, he heard a child's voice sing out, "Take it, read it." It was the Bible talking. Augustine deserted his African concubine, converted to Christianity, and became the scourge of fornicators. And Rangoon is the capital of Burma. This afternoon, however, Kathleen's eyes are not on St. Monica's picture. Kathleen is far, far away in the English countryside, where she lives with her widowed father in a manor house. Kathleen! Kathleen jolts at her desk and looks up into Sister St. Monica's towering wimple.
Yes, sister?
What could possibly be more engrossing than the formation of glacial moraine? Sister St. Monica does not wait for an answer, but seizes Kathleen's novel from behind its camouflage, Geography of the British Empire. Claudia by A.L.O.E. Who, scathing tones, is A.L.O.E.? Kathleen feels herself blush. She looks down.
A lady of England.
I beg your pardon. You have a voice, don't you? Titters from the class. Use it. Kathleen looks up.
A lady of England.
A lady of England what?
A lady of England, sister.
Kathleen swallows as Sister St. Monica scans the page. The other girls start whispering. Silence! Silence. Sister dangles the book before Kathleen and commands, "Share a few gems with the class." Kathleen takes the book and bites her lip. "Loudly and clearly, I, for one, do not wish to miss a single charming word." Kathleen starts anywhere, reads,
"I often catch a glimpse," sing-song,
"I can't hear you, Kathleen."
"Of dark robes,
louder,
passing across the little open space yonder."
"Good, continue."
"With something of the longing for forbidden fruit."
Giggles on all sides. Kathleen takes a breath, blinks, continues.
"Doubtless one would get a knowledge of good and evil by being better acquainted with convent life. I suspect more of the evil than of the good."
Gasps from the other girls. Kathleen waits, her eyes on the book.
"Please don't make me continue."
"Continue."
"But Papa forbade me to hold any intercourse whatsoever with the Romanist ladies."
Silence. Shocked and appalled. Sorrowful sister. "Girls, profit and perpend. This is a piece of unalloyed trash. A libel hatched by a low type of woman whose refusal to publish under her true name testifies to the evil of her intentions. No one but an idiot or a fiend could derive pleasure between its covers. Which, Kathleen, are you?" Kathleen can't look up. All around her, petty triumph. She forces herself to answer, which is in itself a defiance.
"Neither."
Sister St. Monica confiscates the book and swishes away to her desk. Sister St. Monica is the one teacher who does not subscribe to the untouchability of Kathleen Piper. She has been looking for an opportunity to give the girl the gift of mortification, but it hasn't been easy. Kathleen is a model student, and it is well nigh impossible to put one's finger on the insolent pride that colors her flawless manners. Not to mention the unsubstantiated but unmistakable whiff of immodesty. "I'll teach her," thinks Sister St. Monica, locking the offending book in her desk.
"She'll learn," thinks Kathleen, staring at the inkwell, hot with humiliation. "She'll be sorry. I'll kill her with a stake in her heart. I'll be famous, and she'll be ugly and dead.
I'd like to poke out her eye. I'll show her. She's not worth showing.
Kathleen bites her lip, hard.
I'll show them all.
She feels her eyes brim up.
Don't cry. Don't. Stare. Harder.
Kathleen glares out the window at the blast furnaces of Dominion Iron and Steel. Imagines herself bursting in flames from the stack and soaring all the way to La Scala. Or anywhere. So long as it's far from this one-horse burg, this wretched rock, these horrible girls. I said, advance to the front. Kathleen starts and looks up. Sister is waiting on her high platform in front of the blackboard. Ice Age, Cretaceous, mass extinction.
What now?
Kathleen slides from her desk, leaving palm prints on its surface, snagging her woolen stocking on a splinter, and walks the gauntlet of female eyes.
Face the class.
Kathleen obeys. The next thing she knows, she is showered with scrap paper and pencil shavings, and the lights have gone out.
Since you're so eager to fill your head with garbage, says Sister St. Monica, you may as well have a garbage can on your shoulders.
Shrieks of laughter.
That's enough, girls. Now, Kathleen, sing for us.
Kathleen is paralyzed. Blinking into the darkness of the metal can, she feels sweat trickling under her arms, between her legs.
You're a songstress, aren't you?
Whack! The yardstick against the side of the can. Kathleen is spared the sight of row after row of girls, with their hands clamped over their mouths, plugging their noses against hilarity, crossing their legs.
I said, sing!
Only one song presents itself, perversely, to her mind, and she begins, muffled and echoey.
I'll take you home again, Kathleen.
Hysterical laughter. Sister gives them free rein.
Across the ocean, wild and wide.
Louder.
To where your heart has ever been, since first you were my bonny bride.
A bare thread of a voice is all that's available to Kathleen, and it breaks.
Continue.
The roses all have left your cheek. I've watched them fade away and die. Your voice is sad whene'er you speak, and tears bedim your loving eyes.
Kathleen is finally crying, helpless, enraged. What's worse is that she hates this song, old-fashioned, sickly sweet, nothing to do with her but her name.
Oh, I will take you back, Kathleen, to where your heart will feel no pain, and when the fields are fresh and green, I'll take you to your home again.
The song finished, Kathleen waits in dread to be dismissed. How can she possibly remove this can from her head in front of everyone? She knows she must, eventually. Someday. She has to go to the loo. She feels as though she's wet her pants with shame. Surely that's not possible. Surely she would know if she had. Kathleen realizes that she's been standing there for some time, and that Sister St. Monica has resumed the lesson.
And what occasioned the putting aside of St. Augustine's African concubine?
Oh, sister, sister, I know!
One at a time, girls.
Kathleen stands motionless until the bell signals lunch, and she hears Sister St. Monica swish out after the last pupil. Kathleen has no friends. She has her work, and she's grateful for that, because friends are simply not to be had at Holy Angels. Not that Kathleen goes out of her way.
Snob!
Seeing her up there, anonymous, with a green metal garbage can for a head, hiding that conceited face. Why do people think she's so pretty? Her hair is horrible. It's red. That's all it is. Not auburn, not strawberry blonde, red. Like a demon. Like a floozy. Kathleen's ordeal at the hands of Sister Saint Monica soothes a lot of badly ruffled feathers. The truth is, Kathleen has no idea how to go about making a friend. She has been trained to live for that glorious place, the future. Friends are superfluous. This is reinforced by the tacit understanding that she is not to bring anyone home. Something to do with Mama. She and Daddy would never say it, but they both know it. Other girls spend nights at each other's homes, tucked in together, talking till dawn. Kathleen overhears them whispering in the lavatory. She never finds out that Daddy would not let her spend a night at a friend's house, because she is never invited. James is planning to send her all the way to Italy by herself, but that's different. That's life. The other is nonsense. And who knows what another girl's father might get into his head. Kathleen is chaperoned every moment, but she does not see it that way. Freedom consists of being insulated from the envy and ignorance of the unimportant people who temporarily surround her. Now, after 5 years at Holy Angels, Kathleen would not know a friend if one sank its teeth into her wrist, which is more or less what she expects from the mass of other girls. She skirts them cautiously, as if they were dangerous wild animals loitering about a common watering hole, ready to pounce. You'd never know why or what hit you. She fears them, sharp, glinting creatures, and hasn't a clue what they talk about or how they do it, how they merge into gregarious packs. Kathleen is, in fact, horribly shy, but no one would ever suspect it. After all, she gets up and sings in front of halls full of people. What seals Kathleen's fate, however, is the presence of several Mahmood cousins at Holy Angels. One of them has even been in her class for the past 6 years. Though Materia hasn't wanted the girls to know anything at all about the shame of family exile, and has concocted her story about the old country, James has told Kathleen the truth. Your mother and I were very young. We eloped. It was wrong. But what was worse was the behavior of the Mahmoods. Barbaric. They are from a part of the world that hasn't seen a moment's peace in hundreds of years. Little wonder. You have cousins at Holy Angels. Ignore them. Don't give them the opportunity to snub you. Carry yourself like you own the place. The Mahmoods are rich and civic-minded. The Mahmood girls are popular, each of them a gleaming, clear-eyed olive in plaid and perfect English. They have been told that Kathleen is the daughter of the devil, and have duly accorded her a wide berth. To befriend Kathleen is to offend the Mahmood girls. You can't have it both ways. But is there not one potential friend among the horde? One bookish girl, plain as a rainy Tuesday, or so beautiful as to be unafraid? One who does not travel with the pack? Who might come forward as a friend for Kathleen? No. Kathleen's fortress, her tower of creamy white, is steep and terrible. No one comes in or out. Except for her father, Sister Saint Cecilia, and a select few minions necessary to support life, such as her mother, such as the buggy driver. The other girls salve their corrosive energy and allay their fear of Kathleen, the antisocial prodigy, with an invigorating dose of racial hatred.
She may be peaches and cream, but you should see her mother, black as the ace of spades, my dear. You know that sort of thing stays in the blood. Evangeline Campbell's mother's cousin knows a girl had a baby in Louisburg. Black as coal, my dear. And the both their families white as snow and blonde. We should never have let the coloreds into this country in the first place. My uncle saw a colored woman driving a cart with a load of coal. The next morning he was dead. They have a smell. They do. Kathleen Piper belongs in the coke ovens.
And they laugh. Naturally, this remedy is never indulged when the Mahmood girls are around. That wouldn't do. They're nice girls and rich, rich. The brothers of holy angels have already begun lining up. No girlfriend has ever made it up to the tower chamber. Three Sisters. Frances has discovered a new game, exploring the mysteries of the teenager Kathleen. Unfortunately, she is too young to know how to investigate thoroughly without leaving a trace.
Come here, you little brat!
Frances peeks out from behind Mercedes with a guilty twinkle in her eye, her hands folded innocently behind her back, and enters Kathleen's boudoir.
If you come in here again, I'll tell Pete to get after you,
says Kathleen, enthroned at her vanity, where she has just discovered the comb where the brush should be and a candy heart gumming up one of her good lace hankies.
Who's Pete?
Asks Frances.
He's the Bodekin, and he's going to drag you to hell.
Frances laughs. Mercedes' eyes grow round as saucers, and she says,
That's not nice. Not you, sweetie.
Kathleen holds out her arms, and Mercedes approaches. Kathleen pops her onto her knee.
He doesn't get after good little girls. What shall we read? Water babies.
Mercedes chooses Frances' favorite out of love for her little sister, who doesn't mean to be naughty. Kathleen eyes Frances's crooked grin.
Come here, you rascal. You can listen, too.
Frances climbs onto the other knee. The two little girls look at each other and squirm, hands clamped over their mouths, cheeks ballooning with suppressed rapture.
Quit wriggling, or I'll stick you on a pin and use you for bait in the creek.
Mercedes composes herself. Frances shrieks with laughter and asks,
Can I play with your hair? What do you say? Please? What else? With a whole bunch of cream and a cherry and fruit and candy. What else? And a sword and a bug and a worm and a bare bum.
Mercedes says to herself on behalf of Frances,
Sorry, dear God.
Kathleen laughs. And Frances giggles passionately, poised to plunge both hands into the Red Sea, but Kathleen holds out.
What word am I thinking of? Lantern? Nope. Stick? Nope. Matchbox? No. Teapot? Right. Yay! Don't pull it or I'll skin you.
Once upon a time, there was a little chimney sweep. Kathleen has taken to spending time with her little sisters. At first, she does this for Daddy's sake, because she knows that otherwise they get nothing but their mother's barbaric yammer during the day while she's at school. She can smell it hanging in the air when she gets home. But as the school days and the war drag along and Kathleen becomes lonelier, she grows to cherish the time with her little sisters every bit as much as they do. Sunday mornings, she allows them to sit on two stools at the threshold of her room, if I'm in the mood, and witness her toilette. They sit as still as they can, enthralled, while Kathleen sings the world's greatest songs in her opera voice, and slips on a white cotton blouse over her lace-embroidered petticoat. She turns the cuffs, fashions a Windsor knot in her striped silk tie, and pulls on her tan linen skirt, flared at the ankle.
My bicycling costume, she calls it, although she does not possess a bicycle.
Evenings after school, she stands with her arms akimbo at the door to the forbidden chamber and groans,
Oh, all right, you can come in, but not a peep. I'm studying.
The girls always cross the threshold with a sense of awe, for Kathleen's room is a temple of sophistication. Its shelves are lined with every girl's book you could ever think of, from Little Women to Anne of Green Gables. Its walls are plastered with pictures of great artists and beautiful underthings cut from magazines. There is a picture of a man with wild hair and a flying necktie, pouncing upon the keys of a piano. This is Liszt. Kathleen is in love with Liszt. Kathleen says even his name sounds like a romantic sigh. Mercedes and Francis breathe the name to each other as a kind of all-purpose adjective for everything divine. Jello, fresh bed linen, Mama's molasses cookies, all are wonderfully list. There is a picture of a beautiful dark woman in a wide hat and an old-fashioned dress cut low with a rose in her lap. This is Maria Malibran.
La Malibran,
Kathleen says dramatically, the greatest singer who ever lived. Kathleen has told Francis and Mercedes the tragic story of how Malibran went out riding on the wildest horse in the stable. She fell, caught her foot in the stirrup, and was dragged over stones for a mile. She got up, powdered her cuts and bruises, and sang that very night, beautifully as usual. Then she died of a swollen brain, and she was only 28. Mercedes always says a little prayer to herself for Malibran, while Francis tries to put the pretty lady in the picture together with the idea of her being dragged with her head bonking along. It's terrible. There is a big poster of the Woman of a Thousand Faces, although in the poster she has only one. Her name is Eleonora Duse. She has burning dark eyes and piles of black hair. Daddy sent it to Kathleen from England before he went to the front. Duse is the greatest actress who ever lived. In the poster, she stands inside the front hall of a nice house. She is wearing an overcoat, and her hand is reaching for the doorknob. The poster is for a scandalous play called A Doll's House. Daddy sent it with a letter. "To remind me not to get married and wreck my career," Kathleen has explained. Mercedes can't understand why Kathleen would not want to get married and have babies like Mama, but Kathleen just snorts. "Marriage is a trap, kiddo, a great big lobster trap." Every evening when Kathleen opens her door and grudgingly admits them, Mercedes and Francis wait in obedient silence for 5 endless minutes, after which Kathleen proclaims her homework finished. Then there are just too many treats to choose from. Often, all 3 of them wind up lying on their stomachs on Kathleen's bed, chin in hand, going through a priceless issue of Harper's Bazaar, picking out fashions and accessories for those in the know.
"That's me," says Mercedes,
and Kathleen reads the description. "A saucy confection of pale mauve crepe de chine, touched up with rosettes of pussy willow silk."
"Chic,"
says Mercedes wisely.
"Très chic,"
says Kathleen.
"I'm that one,"
Francis points, and Kathleen obliges. She lost her head over this good-looking and comfortable pair of corsets from La Resista. The lace brassiere has the unmistakable Paris hallmark. Francis giggles and echoes,
"Brassiere!"
Even though there's a war on, there's still plenty of fashion pouring out of Paris, although, according to the magazine, the designers only keep it up for the sake of their poor seamstresses, who would otherwise be out of a job. Kathleen teaches her sisters to mimic the effects of rouge by pinching their cheeks, and of lipstick by mercilessly biting their lips.
"Beauty is a powerful weapon,"
she reads, at once sarcastic and enthralled. "To fashion's throne must the free, untrammeled girl be brought for sacrifice." The sisters invariably dine at Sherry's on 5th Avenue, where Kathleen greets them in a French accent.
"Good evening, mademoiselles. What would you like? We have caviar on toast, vol-au-vent of sweetbreads, brandied peach tarts and green turtle soup? Or would you prefer jellied tongue?"
It's not all frivolity, however. Kathleen is religious about reading Lady Randolph Churchill's series on the war by the simmering samovar. The sisters all hold their breath when they come upon a picture of a French casino that's been converted to a hospital. No, Daddy is not there. and Kathleen always reads aloud the latest installment of a racy story while the little girls listen, mystified, and gaze at the illustrations over her shoulder.
Go! You are nothing but a brute!
Kathleen eagerly awaits every issue of Harper's Bazaar that Mrs. Foss of the Orpheus Society passes on to her, and she savors them with a combination of delight and disgust. For example, there is one picture that Kathleen has cut out for her wall just in order to remind herself that Philistines are not confined to her own hometown. They can even be found amid high society. The photograph is supposedly of the great Geraldine Farrar singing Carmen at the Metropolitan Opera House of New York. Yet in the foreground sits a box full of asters admiring each other's jewelry. It had never before crossed Kathleen's mind that people might go to the opera out of anything but a passion for opera.
Let that be a lesson, she thinks, vowing, when I sing, no one will be allowed to look anywhere but at the stage.
There always comes a point when Kathleen flings the Harper's Bazaar across the room and declares herself fed up with frippery and foppery and the silly chits who fill their heads with all that rot.
Rubbish, Mercedes agrees. Foolish burn bottoms, seconds Francis. Francis!
Mercedes is always shocked, and Kathleen always laughs. Then they return hungrily to fairy tales and the Bobbsey twins. Women of Canada say go. I used to walk the sidewalks in Nova Scotia town. There was a man came down, his face was bronzed and brown, told us how King George was calling each to do his share. He offered us a khaki coat to wear. He told us how the call had gone far over land and sea, and when I heard that speaker's word, I said, why, that means me. Marching song of the 85th Overseas Battalion, Canadian Expeditionary Force. His notes arrive quite regularly, on standard military postcards. Dear Mrs., all is well. Do not worry. Love to the girls. James. Nothing is ever blacked out. James never writes enough to give anything away. Materia's heart leaps at the mail because His Majesty's gratitude and regret come on a card of the same size. She tears open the envelope, looking for the black border, but it's never there. In the spring of 16, Mrs. Lvovitz shows up at Materia's kitchen door with little Ralph in tow. The tables are turned. Mrs. Lvovitz is crying.
Here, here, come in. Sit down. Cup of tea.
She slumps over the kitchen table. Materia shoos Ralph away. He hovers in the door with Mercedes and Francis,
who wonder what's wrong with Mrs. Love.
Mrs. Lvovitz reaches out without looking up and clasps Materia's hand. Her boys are going, Abe and Rudy. They thought she'd be proud. They're real Canadians.
Don't worry. They gonna be back soon, says Materia.
For all the papers say there's bound to be a breakthrough any day, the stalemate can't last forever. Mrs. Lvovitz blows her nose, scrapes her face with her hanky.
I know, I know. You don't understand. We have...
And crumples once more.
We have family there.
Her voice creaking upward.
My mother is there.
Your people in Poland, they got no fighting in Poland.
Benny's people in Poland, my people are German.
Materia hugs her while she cries just like a child. Her boys will be fighting their own flesh and blood. The Lvovitzes are real Canadians, and the Feingolds are real Germans. Near the river Somme in summer 1916, there are several innovations. Canadians have helmets and rifles that fire most of the time. Germans have machine guns. July 1, the British plan is this. 1 million shells to cut the Boche wire. Shoulder your 70-pound pack as usual.
Go over the top. Walk toward the German lines. They'll all be dead by now. Keep walking till you hit Berlin. In 4.5 hours, 50,000 Britons and Canadians are shot. That afternoon, the British plan is revised. Do everything as before, but this time, run. Abe is killed walking. Rudy is killed running. Neither of them killed any Germans.
Alehem ha-shalom.
July 2nd, 1916. Dear Mrs., all is well. Mrs. Lvovitz never recovers. She functions, has to. She has her youngest son. She has Benny. And there's Materia, a child still, really.
I remember when I found her on the cliff. What would she do without me?
She took the news about the boys very hard. Materia's husband will probably be killed.
A blessing, God forgive me. I don't know why, but he scares me. Benny says that's prejudice. It isn't. It's superstition. There's something not right. I can't prove it. I can feel it. I may be Meshuggah. One thing I know. I'll maim my son Ralph before I let him go to a war. I'll nail his feet to the floor.
It's begun to sink in on two continents. Younger sons are being dragged away from recruiting stations before they can say, 16, sir, honest. Everywhere, the youngest have suddenly become the eldest. None of this is what Materia intended. Ypres. Gas. At least it kills rats, too. Passchendaele. It doesn't matter if you can swim. Dear Mrs., I am fine. Summer of 17. Number 12 mine where James worked explodes. 65 dead. The war has created a boom in the Sydney coal fields. Full employment, lower wages, and strikes forbidden by law, coal being vital to the war effort. Production has been stepped up, airways left shut, gas building up. Number 12 was always bad that way. Materia plays at many funerals and ponders James's luck and her own stupefying sins.
To whom can she confess?
Not to her dear friend, Mrs. Lvovitz. She tries to tell the priest,
Father, forgive me, for I have sinned. I brought the war.
But he tells her she's guilty only of the sin of pride. Say the rosary 3 times and ask God for humility. So Materia goes unabsolved. She visits the cliff every day in her mind, and every day she swan dives off it, weightless for a moment, feeling the slim girl she used to be, then the sudden satisfying impact of the rocks. It's where she belongs. She craves the caress of the violent shore. To come alive like that once more in a clash of stone, and then to die. Peace. But she has her little girls, and suicide is the unforgivable sin. In the fall of 1917, Our Lady appears to 3 children in Fatima, Portugal, and tells them 3 secrets, the 3rd of which remains a Vatican secret to this day. But Materia knows what the 3rd secret was. It was this. Dear children, I sent the great war in order to shield, a little longer, the body and soul of Kathleen Piper. Dulce et decorum. Now we wear the feather, the 85th feather. We wear it with pride and joy. That fake advertiser, old Billy the Kaiser, shall hear from each blue-nosed boy. Where trouble is brewing, our bit we'll be doing to hammer down Britain's foes. With the bagpipes a-hummin', the 85th comin', from the land where the maple leaf grows. 85th Overseas Battalion, CEF. It must mean something. There are so many of us. Never have so many sacrificed so much for so little. It must mean something. Otherwise there would not be this parade. There would not be this royal inspection, these brassy buttons, these slender wounds in the earth across Europe, these sturdy beams holding back the tide of mud and human tissue, this meticulous network of miniature mines, these lice, these rats, these boots returning unto dust, these toes lying scattered about my feet like leaves, like fallen teeth.
James has spent 3 years in a narrow strip of France and Flanders, dodging snipers in order to collect the dead and comfort the dying. He is not a medic. He just volunteers a lot. Wiring parties, digging parties, reconnaissance parties, one big party. The streamers, fireworks, and ticker tape that sent them off are nothing compared to the bright bits of man that sail through the air and festoon the remaining trees here in the land of permanent November. These decorations will stay up for years. Chloride of lime to kill the stench, cordite to kill the lice, whale oil to keep the feet from rotting. 54 days at a stretch in the flooded mass grave of the living, but he never complains. James has prolonged the lives of so many men that he has been mentioned in dispatches several times. Originally, he was recommended for the Victoria Cross. But as the great adventure dragged on, his brand of conspicuous gallantry reflected poorly on the war. Once, a wrecked man called him Mummy and clutched at the buttons on James's chest. Nothing was surprising. James let the boy from Saskatchewan suck on one of his brass buttons before dying. The mother country. The mud between the opposing trenches is known as no man's land. This is a reasonable name for a stretch of contested ground that has yet to be won by either side. But James, and possibly a number of others along the line, have forgotten that this is the origin of the name. The name has come to mean a haunted, foggy expanse of silent slime. A limbo, gray, yellow, green, mostly gray, and empty except for the dead. Rats may scamper across it and remain rats. Birds may fly above it and remain birds. They may alight and tear and eat and prick up their heads to stare motionless and beady for a moment, before pecking and eating again, and remain birds. But no man may venture into this space between the lines and remain a man. That is the difference. No man may enter, either stealthily on his belly alone, or noisily on 2 feet racing through glue with 1,000 versions of himself, firing, falling on either side as far as the eye can see, and remain a man. It is possible to become a man once more if you make it back behind your line again, but you suspend your humanity for your sojourn in between. That is why the place is called No Man's Land. By 1916, James had volunteered so often that other men assumed he had a death wish. Either that or he was protected, by an angel of Mons, perhaps, or Old Nick. They didn't know whether it was lucky to stick close to James, or if that was asking for the next bullet that missed him by an inch. Before a night raid or a dawn attack, when other men were tucking Bibles into their left breast pockets, kissing love letters or a lucky rat's paw, James was relaxed against a reeky sandbag full of mud and pieces of former men, reading. James's first act of total disregard for his own safety was in the fall of 1915. 5 men had gone out after dark with their bouquets of barbed wire, and 4 came back, but no one had heard a shot or a shout. That meant the 5th man was out there, lost, wandering around in the place of no reference points. German Very lights bloomed in the sky from 3 directions, adding confusion to danger. Briefly lit, a shattered tree, a sea of craters, corpses interchangeable, now pink, now bronze, now blue. On the Western Front, there is nothing so colorful as the night. James went out after the 5th man. He wasn't a friend. He was just some fella.
After 2 hours, he found the man walking toward the German line. James brought him in, but he didn't make friends with him or anyone else. On Christmas Day, 1914, the British and the Germans had laid down their arms, climbed out of their trenches, and walked into no man's land. They met halfway between the lines and exchanged gifts. Not so strange, considering that never before had so many nice men with families and decent jobs volunteered to face each other under arms across distances as brief and static as 20 yards. Such chocolate. Such bully beef. The truce was completely spontaneous and not repeated in anything like those numbers again. Somehow, people can still get into the Christmas spirit when they've only been mowing each other down with ordinary bullets. But the festivity goes right out of the season once they've gassed each other. Nonetheless, James brought over a gift on the Christmas of 1916. At night, you tell yourself that the howls and whimpers out there are wild dogs. This gets difficult if one of the dogs starts praying. The night before Christmas, James had already brought in 2 wounded, and he was out looking for another. By the light of a flare, he saw 2 dead stretcher-bearers lying at either end of a stretcher containing a bandaged man, an unusual sight in that the dead were whole. As the flare died, James saw the man on the stretcher stir. He approached, but found the man was dead after all, a feast for the rats that had turned him over in the course of their meal. James carried on, blind man's buff, listening for any sound that was not a rustling or a gnawing. He stopped and crouched over a whimper. He felt for arms, legs, and guts. If the guts are merely exposed, it's worth picking him up. Otherwise, finish him off quietly. This man was in pretty good shape, though unable to walk. And when he answered James's, "How you doing, buddy?" with, "Ich will nicht sterben, bitte," James picked him up and walked east. When they got close to the German trench, the man cried out to his comrades, "Nicht schießen, nicht schießen." James laid him down within arm's reach of the parapet, turned around, and walked back to his own side. James could do all this because he had made a bargain with himself. He wouldn't try to get killed, nor would he try to survive. He could do all this because he felt terribly sorry for the men he rescued. They harbored the saddest and most foolish desire of all, the desire to go on living. The Bobbseys at home. One evening, Kathleen has instructed Mercedes and Frances to play on their own while she finishes a letter to Daddy. School is great. Lots of fun. By now, she finds their chatter less distracting than their eager silence. Frances is at the reins of the covered wagon they've made from Kathleen's bedspread. "When I grow up, I'm going to have so much hair and be the boss of everything, and I'll be singing and eating candy." Mercedes is the pioneer mother with the babies. "Me too. And when I grow up, I'm going to the old country and visit Sitti and Jitti." "Me too." Kathleen looks up from her letter. "They're not in the old country. What are you talking about?" Frances clicks her tongue at the horses. Mercedes comforts the monkey baby and answers, "Yes, because they prospered. But then they miss the fruits and diamonds." "They darn well live in Sydney," says Kathleen. Frances blinks and the horses disappear. The babies cool to porcelain and rubber in Mercedes' arms. "Mama said..." "I don't care what she said. They live in Sydney, and they hate us. They're stupid, rotten idiots, and we're better off without them." Kathleen tosses her pencil onto the desk and stands up. "What shall we read?" Frances looks to Mercedes. Mercedes says, "The magazine?" "No,
Kathleen decrees. The red shoes! Francis enthuses. Oh, yes, and she gets her feet chopped off.
Mercedes bursts into tears. Then so does Francis.
She does not get her feet chopped off, says Kathleen.
Francis sobs.
She does! She does!
Mercedes wails. She does!
Not if I say she doesn't. But they are inconsolable, clinging to each other and crying for Mama.
What a couple of sissies. Come on, we'll read something else.
She wipes their noses, hands Frances her hairbrush, and settles Mercedes in her lap.
Can we sleep with you tonight?
Oh, all right. Get in.
Yay!
And when they've snuggled down,
now clam up and listen.
The Bobbsey twins at the seashore. It's wonderful when Kathleen reads, because she does all different voices and accents.
So you lib, we do keep a movin',
cries Dinah, as she climbed into the big depot wagon. Dinah, the colored maid, had been with the family so long, the children called her Dinah Bobbsey, although her real name was Mrs. Sam Johnston. Downstairs, Materia wrings her hands before a big bout of cleaning and baking. She received a telegram today. James is coming home. Boots. On a cold April afternoon in 1917, James got the inspiration for his boot business from a French soldier near Vimy. The Frenchman wandered skeletal from the fog, his bare feet sucking the yellow muck where James was looking for wounded. The Frenchman drove his thumbs into either side of James's windpipe, slamming him into the slime, holding his head under. Then he went to work on James's boots, slicing the laces. James wrenched up and stuck the man. Luckily, no one saw for the fog. The French were our allies. From that moment, boots are all James can think about. It's the only thing that will drown the sound of his bayonet scraping between Frenchie's peekaboo ribs, and the sight of him scarecrowing off the end when James managed to shoot free.
Under and up, ladies, under and up!
Boots are what count, more than weapons, food, or strategy. We will win because we have more and better boots. Boots determine history. Warm, dry feet will allow us to go on being killed longer than the enemy. When the enemy's boots wear out, they will no longer be able to run in waves into our machine gun fire, and they will surrender. I'm going to be ready for the next war by making boots. I'll be rich enough to send my daughter to the conservatory in Halifax for a year, then to anywhere in the world. But not Milan or Salzburg or even London. The old world is a graveyard. Is it not fine to dance and sing when the bells of death do ring? No, it isn't. The great music will immigrate to the new world. New York. James can smell it. He has a distant cousin there, an old maid with an odd first name. Giles, that's it. She works with the nuns. Everything is turning out beautifully. Everything's going to be fine. Spit and polish, rise and shine. James starts polishing his boots every day. Sometimes all day, because often all day is all there is. Between the rips and rotten bits, around his exposed toes, the remains of James's boots positively glow through the perpetual fog. The other men call him Rudolph. It is this habit of the boots that prevents James from yet another tour of duty, although he's volunteered. His supervisors determine that he is no longer fit for combat conditions. Sticking someone is perfectly normal in the mud culture. Obsessively polishing a pair of disintegrating boots is not. It's shell shock. James's superiors do not refer to him as Rudolph. They call him Lady Macbeth. Along with an invisible part of himself, James loses a toe.
It falls off, painlessly, and is seized and carried away by a rat right before his eyes. If the shell shock hadn't got him, this thing with the toe would have. So, out of consideration for a man's pride, shell shock is not what James's superiors write on his discharge. Officially, he is invalided out because of the injury to his foot. James is taken out of the drowning pools of Passchendaele and across the channel to Buckingham Palace, where he is awarded the Distinguished Service Order for extreme devotion to duty in the presence of the enemy. During the ceremony, he looks from people's footwear to their faces and decides whether or not they match. He is shipped home to be honorably discharged. No one can know how tired he is. He will be tired for the rest of his life. When James sees Halifax Harbor from the deck of the troop ship in December 1917, he revises his plans for Kathleen. He'll have to send her straight to New York City. Halifax has been blown up. He doesn't wonder how or why. The war has grazed the edge of Canada, is all. The Candy of Strangers. A war changes people in a number of ways. It either shortcuts you to your very self, or it triggers such variations that you may as well have been a larva, pupating in dampness, darkness, and tightly wrapped puttees. Then, providing you don't take flight from a burst shell, you emerge from your khaki cocoons so changed from what you were that you fear you've gone mad, because people at home treat you as though you were someone else. Someone who, through a bizarre coincidence, had the same name, address, and blood ties as you, but who must have died in the war. And you have no choice but to live as an impostor, because you can't remember who you were before the war. There's a simple but horrible explanation for this. You were born in the war. You slid, slick, bloody, and fully formed out of a trench. The Great War was the greatest changer of them all. James has one thing in common with the man who marched off to the wars 3 years before. Their daughter, Kathleen. On December 10th, 1917, he steps off the train in Sydney, an unexploded shell. He has had a few years' practice being present and absent at the same time, so he is able to find his way from Sydney to New Waterford. He walks the 9 miles of frosted dirt road in his civvies, his duffel bag over his shoulder, and with each step his mind says, "Sydney, New Waterford, Sydney, New Waterford." To his left is Europe. Several people see him enter town and walk down Plummer Avenue. They don't know he is a hero. They just know he has survived when most died, are still dying. James walks up the steps onto his veranda and is able to say hello to his wife as though she were someone he once knew, pat two little girls who squeal and call him Daddy, and avoid the eyes of the one person who is all too real. He walks past her into the house and up to the attic. He puts his bayonet in the hope chest. He ignores the military doctor's orders and gets straight to work. He must banish her before he gets used to being alive again. Kathleen is worried but tries to be grown up about it. "It's not that Daddy doesn't love me anymore. It's that the war was so terrible." James builds a shed off to the side of the house and a workbench to go in it. Christmas comes and goes, but he takes no notice, despite the excitement of